Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Michael McClintock, with live coverage of the funeral of Selina Meyer, America's first woman president. While she may have only served one full term, Meyer is fondly remembered for briefly freeing what was once known as the Nation of Tibet, as well as for permanently overturning same-sex marriage. The former president passed away earlier this week at the age of 76 or possibly 77, or according to some sources, 75.
Hello, and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. If you're a comedy nerd like I am, you know Matt Walsh as one of the four founders of the Upright Citizens Brigade, along with Matt Besser, Ian Roberts, and Amy Poehler. He's also a two-time Emmy nominee for playing Mike McClintock on Veep, which just wrapped up its seventh and final season on HBO last month. This month, Walsh and UCB are bringing the 21st annual Del Close Marathon, 3 days of some of the best improv shows you'll ever see, to Los Angeles after 20 years in New York. I thought this would be the perfect opportunity to look back at what has been easily the most influential comedy institution of this century with the man who has been there from the beginning. Here's my conversation with the great Matt Walsh. This is The Last Laugh.
CBS hat, or is that a prop CBS hat?
A real CBS hat that we got from Colbert. We shot a sketch during our last episode. Press tour, and this was Mike's hat for the bit. And
I lose hats so much, I just turned it into, and I wiped out the CBS, so I'm not promoting it with a blue highlighter.
I don't think that worked very well.
No, but at least it's prettier. It's definitely prettier. And then my wife hates it, so I'll wear this until I lose it.
So, yeah, I mean, I definitely want to talk about the Del Close Marathon, but I figured we could start with a little Veep talk since we just wrapped up a couple weeks ago. So how are you feeling now that it's officially in the past?
It doesn't feel in the past because I'm going in next week to do DVD commentary again, my second DVD. And then so I still see people, saw Dave the other day, but the whole show, of course, is done. And I've said it a million times. I think cried my eyes out in December. A lot of farewells, a lot of hugs, a lot of meaningful thank yous and gratitude. And then just kind of moved on a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a wonderful show, and I'm so happy that the seventh season was so strong. I mean, generally people reviewed it really well, and I loved how the writers. Dave and Julia, everyone got to sew it all up together in that last episode. I thought that was one of the more interesting episodes of television I've been a part of.
Yeah, absolutely. The finale I thought was incredible. I mean, what did you, when you got that script, what were your sort of initial reactions to it?
The things insane and like the time jump, like it's nice to be able to not worry about spoilers right now because so much of the press you
we
were
can
always
talk about
behind.
It.
Yeah. It was wonderful to and crazy to see like 24 years later in a script, in a Veep script. It was just so fun. I'm like, oh my God, they're really – that's a great concept. And it was obviously exciting to sit in the room occasionally. I would sit in the writer's room and hear them pitch ideas for what the future could be. And it's just – it was really exciting to have that kind of ending in the final episode. And then, of course, the sort of betrayal of Gary was sort of the hugest, you know, awful thing. I think they knew – she had to do something awful to get the prize and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they designed like, what's the awful thing? And I think it was like throwing Gary under the bus or putting Gary in prison. And then there's just moments that I loved from the get-go that are small moments, but just are wonderfully written and created moments. Like when Hugh Laurie comes in and Selena has thrown the Me Too bomb.
Mm-hmm.
To the aide he's having sex with or his chief of staff, and that's blown up in his face and his career and certainly his campaign are over and he's hot. And knowing their history, and he comes in the room when she's brokering with, I forget who, she's brokering her presidential run with some delegate.
Yeah.
And he's like, what the hell? What kind of person? What the fuck are you? Like, he's shocked yeah. at how evil she is. And the ending moment of that is he goes crazy and she lays into him a little bit, but she's very controlled. And then she goes back to her meeting and she just looks up at him and takes a moment and then just like mm-hmm. ushers him away with his hand and say, you can go. Like, that moment I've witnessed the way power shifts in a room and you are the last person to realize
yeah.
that the power has shifted.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so well constructed. So I think of moments like that.
Yeah.
That's a very deep dive on a small moment. But stuff like that makes me happy.
Yeah. I mean, and your character, Mike McClintock, in the 24 years later, is now a network anchor, kind of a Walter Cronkite type presence.
Yeah.
So do you think that's a fitting end for him, you know, in the failing upwards sense?
In the failing upwards sense, yeah. I think he has always been good in front of, like, the microphone. Like, he does have that talent. He can tell stories to the media, basically, mm-hmm. And then he learns to be part of the media. So it is a logical progression for him. And I think it's a big success for him, of course, like, to be Walter Cronkite. That was, I think he did not see that coming.
Mm-hmm. You and the cast, reunited on Colbert, pretty recently, like around when the finale aired. So that was, you had wrapped at that point a while back. So what was that like to kind of get back together and actually in character do a sketch with Colbert?
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. The process came back right away, like the sort of professional and obsessive work to comedy, because Dave was there and Julia was there and mm-hmm. we were all there, and bringing Colbert into our process because he was a real fan, I think was neat to see, like, everybody just coming together to serve a joke. Like, everybody is really good at their game and it's sort of fluid. And so it was neat to see that process that happens on Veep every day to also happen in the late night writer's room with the host of that show, Steven, who I've known forever since Chicago, who's a famous person in his own right, but also a geeked out crazy fan of mm-hmm. our show.
Yeah.
And then to see this sort of professional machine gel was pretty fun.
Wait a minute. I know you. You're that guy with the with that show.
The Colbert Report.
Coco Report. That's the
one
I just said.
No, I don't do that anymore. That was just a self-involved character I played, like you people.
What?
No, on my earth, I now host The Late Show on CBS. No, I'm not kidding. I do.
You're telling me CBS hired Where's Waldo's pedophile brother? H. Carson, another 85 pounds of generic white male mediocrity that shops at the lesbian warehouse.
That's not a very nice thing to say.
I mean, seriously, you look like Letterman took the least funny dump of his life into a child suit.
2 points, Selena Dore.
Madam President, please. My America is in danger.
Madam President, please. My America.
Okay, that's not what I sound like.
That's not what I sound like.
Look, if you keep doing this here, eventually.
If you keep doing this here.
Maybe we should listen to him.
You people are sick. You are the most amoral bunch of self-centered monsters I have ever met. And I've interviewed Bradley Cooper. You know what? Forget it. I'm leaving. Y'all can go to hell. I'm a big fan. Great show.
What show?
Live from New York. It's Saturday night.
Mike?
Yeah. So you crossed paths with him in Chicago. Did you work together in those
no,
days?
No, he was probably like on the main stage or the ETC when I was just coming into comedy.
Mm-hmm.
He was like a performer with Amy Sedaris and Paul Danello and Mitch Rouse and probably maybe Dave Pasquazi.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like that era. But I've always crossed paths with him at The Daily Show. He was a very nice dude at The Daily Show. He was there when I started. And I've seen him, you know, in various – I did an episode of his TV show, Strangers with Candy.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always seen him in New York and stuff like that. And he improvised with us when we first landed in – New York. He was one of the first guys who was looking to do improvs on Sunday.
Oh, wow.
Nights. Yeah. Someone's singing.
Someone's singing outside. That's never happened before. So before we move on from Veep, I do want to get your reaction to the big news of yesterday, which was Sarah Huckabee Sanders stepping down as a former press secretary yourself. What do you think about that?
When Spicer was in there, people are like, oh my God, he's Mike McClintock. And Mike was bad at his job before Spicer came around, first of all. So we weren't impersonating Spicer. But I say the same thing. It's like, you have to quit your job. If you work for a terrible administration and they're lying all the time and they're corrupt, like, at some point, I understand grabbing the brass ring for 3 months to get that job because you've been kicked around D.C. But after a while, like, you have to quit that. Otherwise, you're an awful person.
Mm-hmm.
So good riddance to Sarah. I mean, whatever. but you hung in there way too long, would be my thing to her. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
It was a terrible person.
Did say she's never been prouder of anything she's done than working for Trump. So I'm not sure if she feels the way that you're imagining.
No, I guess she serves that. It's beyond. Well, I have my view of what common sense is. So I guess I'll have to sit down with her and she'll have to tell me why that's a valuable agenda. Yikes. I don't even know what's happening out of that White House.
What do you feel like you learned about politics and maybe that job in particular by playing this character in terms of how the communication in the political world works?
I think it humanized it. I think there's, like, you know, a blind faith in D.C. like that existed in, you know, the West Wing, Aaron Sorkin, like faith in this American idealism. And then there's also the frightening thing we're learning now, which is like, oh, my God, there's very little that's under control sometimes. Like, what is happening? And so being inside of Veep for those years, you realize that a lot of that, like, oh, there's so much chaos going on behind the scenes or whatever, is just human flawed ego or, you know, compromised ideals or pettiness, vanity, you know, things like that driving the agenda. I think that is stuff I learned on the journey of Veep. And then, simple.
Yeah. You said it humanized that position in a sense. Did it give you, sympathy for someone like Sean Spicer, who was, you know, was being hammered every day in the
press? I have very clear thoughts on this. To me, it's a timeline. I don't know what the days are. It's like, I get wanting that job. Like, I think you want to serve that administration or get that job and be at the top of the heap and have a career. And I do think, like, for those people who are in the communications world, like, that's the best job you could have. Like, you're relevant. Like, these stories are coming out of your mouth for the day. So that's, you know, that's what you want to try to do. But at some point, I don't know, even if you're a conservative, like, you can't work there. That's just not a good person you're working for. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
Coming up, Matt Walsh talks about the origins of UCB when it was just four young comedians making each other laugh. So I want to talk about the Del Close Marathon, the 21st annual, moving to LA for the first time after 20 years in New York. I guess first, why are you moving this event to LA for the first time?
Well, LA has its own charms. It has Hollywood. It has the star machine. Is somewhere in this town where they make stars. So we wanted to be close to the LA sexiness. Also, we all live here. The four of us live here, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just easier. And then
you and the four UCB
Matt,
founders.
Amy and Ian, yeah. We all live here in LA, so it's easier for us to be here. And then the other thing is, people don't have to fly to New York, or we don't have to fly people to New York anymore. Just keep it simple. And we have two theaters here, so I think it was to simplify it.
Mm-hmm.
In a very, in a good way. But I'm excited to see what LA's take on it is, because it was always this down and dirty, rowdy party in the basement of New York, sweaty and under, like, the facilities were always lacking. It's like people drinking in hallways or in roof corners or, you know, getting high somewhere they shouldn't be. And LA is a little nicer in general. So it'll be interesting to see what incarnation the festival takes when the rowdy stuff happens.
Yeah, I mean, Del Close, for anyone who doesn't know, is this kind of mythical figure in the improv world. I mean, what do you think, what do people not know about him that you think that they should know about Del Close?
I'm going to assume that people don't know that Del Close is sort of the founding father of long form improvisation. He was a Second City performer and director, and unfortunately, lifelong, like, heroin addict, battled with serious drug addiction, but is someone I studied with. Mm-hmm. The ECB guys all studied with him. He was sort of the spokesman for why long form could exist as a show unto itself and not just a tool to generate improv for sketch shows at Second City. So there was like this fissure of belief of like improv is worthy of a show unto itself. And then people are like, it's just a tool. You use it to generate materials and you mm-hmm. script that material. And
yeah. That was sort of the Second City model, right? Was yes. was using improv to create a scripted show. Mm-hmm. So before Del Close, there wasn't really – people weren't putting on improv shows in the same way, do you think?
Long forms. They're called long forms. There's a thing called the Herald, which is like a structured, you know, opening exploration of a word and then three scenes and then what's called a group game. And then those three scenes come back in a second beat and then you do another group game and then you sort of in the third beat – third visitation of these scenes, you sort of try to look for connections to sort of wrap it up and give it a closure or ending. Mm-hmm. And so that was a formalized version of a long form. Nothing scripted, nothing is dedicated in terms of like what you're going to say or how many people could be in that scene or what the subject matter is. It's true improv, but you start from usually a simple suggestion and then you go through that. And they're like 45 minutes usually or 30 mm-hmm. minutes, something like that.
Yeah. So you said, you know, you studied under Del Close. What was that experience like for you? What do you remember about maybe the first time that you met him? And
he was a notorious crank. He was an ornery, obstinate, vulgar, seemingly sexist, or he would say the most like provocateur statements and also brilliant. So I was in complete fear of him. He was sort of like John Houseman in The Paper Chase, old mm-hmm. movie reference, but the intimidating professor.
Yeah.
And he would cut people up. If you tried to be funny, he would make you feel embarrassed and like selfish. He's like, oh, well, you took what was a normal scene. And by the way, everyone does an impression of Del Close. You took a normal scene and made it about you and your pompous stand-up or your bullshitty stand-up. Congratulations. Are you happy now? Do you want to thank your scene partners for letting you take the stage and bore us with your material? Like he would say things like that after a show or after a scene. But he also, conversely, because this, us old guys, when we were starting comedy, there was like Second City was a way to achieve a living or earn a living. But that was about it. Mm-hmm. You'd have to go to L.A. or New York. But what Del sort of did and what UCB has continued to do is it sort of formalized like a comedy education. Like Del gave us reading lists. He's like, if you want to be a professional satirist, you should read these five books and you should read the paper every day. And he made you approach it in a formalized way, even though who knows if it would be a career. Like nobody makes money improvising, in truth, very mm-hmm. few. But the formalization of like your profession, he made it aspirational. He made you want to be that guy. And life experience, he said you should travel. So he was always pushing form. So he was like a guru inspiration. He was always pushing form. So it wasn't just the Herald, but it was like he would have a fascination with movies and how movies can manipulate ideas. But to do that on stage, you needed to do things like cut to or zoom in. And these were inventive things that became a form called the movie
mm-hmm.
that like a team called The Family spent time with Del developing. He also was like obsessed with video games and like how to like express things in the way that the early pre-internet was sort of getting to, basically video games. Mm-hmm. So we would do forms where you were trying to tell narrative inside a video game. So pretty trippy stuff. Or you would like chant. Besser told some story how they chanted for like 50 minutes. And then he's like, all right, now how long do you think that was? And they're like, I don't know, 10 minutes? He's like, no, that was 50 minutes. And that was an improv lesson or something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he was always hungry to innovate and he inspired anybody that walked in the room, I think.
So you started the Del Close Marathon. The first one was in 1998, I believe.
Sounds
so 20,
about right.
21 years ago. So what was the sort of the idea there to use his name and create this event that's now been going on for
Del
so long?
I think Del had recently passed. Mm-hmm. So he was a voice on our sketch show, Upright Citizens Brigade sketch show. He was like the voice over in the beginning. So I think to pay tribute to him, we threw a festival that was going to be like 24 hours or all night basically mm-hmm. at our theater that had just opened on 22nd Street. So we just called some people, and some Chicago people were in town. Guys like, I think Pasquazi was there, who was basically a Second City guy, did a little I.O. And we all just got to, and then the whole UCB community, my buddy Pete Holney, who was kind of like an Improv Olympic guy, we all ended up on stage doing a series of shows. And we found, I believe, some old clips of Del. To make him part of the festival, we would play a clip from some weird TV show Del did, and then we would do some improv off of that, mm-hmm. you know, connecting yeah. him to the live theater.
And then last year, the last year you did it in New York, there was a big show at Carnegie Hall where the founders and some other people, including, I think, Tina Fey, and I'm not sure who else was in that show.
Rachel Dratch, Horatio Sands.
Yeah. Did an ASCAT. So can you explain what an ASCAT is and how that kind of got started?
ASCAT is our oldest form. It's basically when we landed in New York, we had two stage shows that we had run in Chicago forever, and then a trunk full of props. And then we also started doing a free improv show on Sunday nights at this little theater. And the improv show was called ASCAT. And ASCAT basically is a long form that you get a guest monologist. They tell some stories off of a suggestion. They just free associate, give us details. We listen to those stories, like six or seven performers on the back wall. Mm-hmm. Initially, it was just the four UCB members and a couple writers from Conan or SNL mm-hmm. with us Chicago dudes. And after they tell their monologue, they take a seat on a chair, and then we do a bunch of scenes that sort of deconstruct elements of that monologue or explore something that was funny or interesting and just do scene work. And then at some point, we bring the monologist back out, and they can continue to tell another story related to scenes we did or something they wanted to continue in the first monologue, or we can get another suggestion, and then we do two halves of that. Mm-hmm. That's an ASCAT.
So what was it like doing that at Carnegie Hall? I mean, that must have been kind of a big moment.
It was a time marker. It was like we landed in New York in 96, and we started doing our free show on Sunday nights, maybe 3 months later, 2 months later, whenever we found a theater that would have us. And it was instantly free show, sold out. So it's not really sold out, but it was instantly full, and the line was around the block. And that was the thing that really connected with our fans and the people who are now in our lives. Like all those people who saw the early ASCAT shows are now people like Paul Scheer and Rob Hubel and mm-hmm. Owen Burke, and they're performers, and Katie Dippold, and they're writers. Like, so that 20 years also was filled with our friends who we had taught improv to, and they had sort of come up with us or come up a little after us. And that gave a retrospective feel to the evening. You know, and so that was a really wonderful, and obviously Carnegie Hall is the storied, like it's there are certain things I've done in my life that my mom likes, and she loves when I'm on a commercial because she can say, did you see the breakfast sausage commercial that Matt's on? So she has something to show her friends, and she loved that she could tell her friends I was at Carnegie Hall, and she got to go to the show. And then the best part of Carnegie Hall is right when the show's over, I was bringing my mom out to take a picture on stage, and the stage hands, and you get off stage, get off the stage. Someone could get hurt. Get out of here. Right. And they just like shoo you like with anger because we got another show tomorrow night, folks. But it's so special and meaningful to you. But once it's over, they don't care.
It's over.
Yeah, it's over.
I mean, I'm sure when you started this group, Upright Citizens Brigade, you couldn't have imagined that you would be performing at Carnegie Hall, 20 years later.
No, never in a million years. Yeah. Absolutely not. We started it as a clubhouse. We were doing shows at that improv show at Solo Arts on the fifth floor of a rickety building. And then we found a strip club that Giuliani shut down. Because we were teaching so many classes, we were able to like pay rent and do our own shows and leave our props there and like have these people who were beginning to be funny do their shows. Mm-hmm. Because we were directing them anyways or coaching them. Yeah. So it was a simple like clubhouse. And we could do what we wanted to do because those shows, those ASCATs, generated material for season two and season three of the sketch show.
Yeah.
It was all very practical.
I remember hearing a story. At one point, were you performing in an old massage parlor?
Was a strip club and then upstairs was kind of like where you could go for massages or whatever else happened
in
upstairs.
Quotes, massages,
So
you would have people kind of wander in.
True.
Yeah.
Sailors, a lot of Orthodox Jewish men. It was funny. And it was like, and then they would always pretend to like look at a flyer. Oh, this is why I'm here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, maybe I'll. And they would put the flyer down and leave because there was no naked people.
Yeah.
No naked women.
So when you started the group with Matt Besser, Ian Roberts, and Amy Poehler, where were you in your life at that point?
Where was I? Was I in my life?
Or in your life and career? You know, what was sort of happening at that time when I met
Besser and Amy and Ian? I guess like Chicago for me was I did psychology right out of college. I was going to be a psychologist, and then I lived with like four other people in a comedy ghetto doing sketches at night. So I, right out of college, I was like, for 2 years, I was working hard during the day on a psych ward, taking some classes towards a psych degree, a master's degree. And then at night doing filming and sketches and running around Chicago, burning the candle at both ends. And then at some point I knew psychology was just too depressing and too difficult. So I kind of dedicated myself to be, you know, a comedian, which means, okay, I just need to be willing to be poor and I need cheap rent and I'll just keep doing shows. And so I started doing places like the Annoyance Theater, studied with a guy named Mick Napier. Around that time, I think I probably met Besser and we were doing shows at this place called the Roxy. The Roxy was like a stand-up anything club, music, also sketch. People like Emo Phillips and Judy Tenuta came out of there. Besser and I kind of met, started film. He had a camera. We started filming things all the time. Shortly thereafter, I met Ian, and then a year or two after that, I met Amy. And in that era of like us all meeting, UCB was doing shows. I was doing shows at Annoyance. I would do, and then Ian and I became touring partners in Second City. So that was my first paying comedy job in 1994. And so I toured the country with Ian Roberts, Horatio Sanz, and a couple other people. And that's kind of like where my life began. So, and then UCB moved to New York in 96. That was me, Besser, and Amy. And then in 98, we got a show in a theater, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that must have been a big decision to take it to New York. Was that a hard decision?
It was for me. I'm from Chicago. So that was my home. And I have a very, you know, pretty close family. And all my siblings are still there. And so it was like a sit-down dinner with the four of us. And Ian, I think at that time, was just about married. And it was a big sit-down, and we kind of agreed to a six-month, let's either go to New York or L.A. We decided New York because New York fed audiences. There was more like theater-going audience, and we felt like we could build a following as opposed to L.A. is a showcase, and then you're gone.
Yeah.
So we chose New York, and booked two theaters or one theater and did just hit the ground running with two shows, and then performed in all these little like variety shows, Luna Lounge, or David Wayne and the State Guys had a show called Stella, or like the Sklar Brothers had a early show. So you just make a name for yourself in New York every night.
And I mean, I don't know if you viewed it this way, but were you kind of setting yourself up in opposition in any way to something like Second City or these more established places? And how did you want it to be different from those institutions that already existed?
I think Second City, when I was coming up, was the institution. Mm-hmm. So they were the thing to rebel against. So places like The Annoyance, for example, started by a guy who directed shows at Second City. He just wanted to have a freer process and not worry.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
about like tourist laughs, as he would, as to say it simply, like sometimes mm-hmm. their shows would play to simpler Chicago, you know, just referencing the name of the assistant mayor can get you a laugh in that room. And that's not necessarily for a young, angry person in comedy. Interesting. You know, mm-hmm. you want to be more subversive. So a lot of these other theater groups, Improv Olympic, where Dell was with Sharna, tried to be a little more subversive and more reaction and certainly improv friendlier. And so I don't know what the question was, I guess.
Well, yeah. How did you want what you were doing to be different from what Second City was doing?
In truth, a lot of it was, I think, misguided. You knew what you liked and you were figuring out how to do it. So we did some shows that alienated audiences because they were so aggressive, and some shows that were really funny. But we knew, I mean, for me personally, I don't know, like, it's kind of judgmental, like, because you don't, you know, like people like probably Steve Carell was on main stage at Second City when I was in Chicago thinking I was doing better work. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So there was talent at Second City, but the structure of Second City was very restrictive and the subject matter, and you couldn't go over the edge because they were sort of like tourist driven. Mm-hmm. So I think we just wanted to do edgier material, whatever we felt was pushing the line. That's what we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And was there a early kind of breakthrough in that sense where you did something where you said, oh, well, this is representative of that edgy material that we want to do? Because I know there were kind of a lot of outrageous, you know, whether you want to call them pranks or things that you guys did that kind of tricked the audience in some way.
I think the audience interaction stuff was pretty cutting edge, or certainly in Chicago, nobody was doing it. I think having a sketch show with a theme, like the underlying theme of Upright Citizens Brigade. So you have like sketches, but you're also linked by this underground subversive organization, I think was different. Mm-hmm. So we were finding ways and also taking characters from our sketch show, like Besser played a Unabomber. And then we had hidden camera footage of him mailing a package at the U.S. Post Office as dressed as that sketch of the Unabomber. We had like weird... we did this in New York years later, but it was Ian. We had a product called Santa Liqueur, which was unconscious or whatever, basically marketing children to be early drunks by associating Santa with the liqueur. And we put Ian outside of FAO Schwartz offering free samples of Santa Liqueur, not to kids. And they got so mad at him. But that was a sketch from our sketch show. And then we took the character and put him in the real world. We were doing that stuff in Chicago. A lot of like early attempts at like virtual reality where we would put goggles on somebody. And they would, we get the audience to create like, okay, now you're in the ocean or whatever. Mm-hmm. The audience might convince them they're in the ocean, or take them outside and put them on a car ride, film the car ride, and then play the video when we got back. They would do stuff like that. So that was kind of pushing it. There was a show called Thunderball that like Besser, Ian, I wasn't in that version of a show early on, but it was like a new sport. I was in the sport, which is like, cars can drive, there's a gun circle, dogs can roam the field. So we filmed this crazy sport, Mad Maxy kind of feeling sport. And those kind of things, I think, weren't happening at Second City. They weren't introducing video clips in their show. And so there were ways we knew. And like our heroes at the time, too, were Kids in the Hall, I think. They were a gestalt. They were a group mind. It wasn't just like Second City was all-star teams and they would take the best person and create diversity, also gender concerns and things like that. But they were just putting – we had like a group mind. Like UCB had an attitude and an edge, and we all sort of like a band had a thing that was better, the four of us, than four individuals. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of what we were trying and figuring it out. Like, you know, many failed attempts. One thing I always remember about UCB is like we did so many shows where we put them up before they were audience ready.
Yeah.
Just and then invite a friend or two or just regular audience, and it was too long. But every – just keep learning. Next show we'd make it 5 minutes shorter and it'd be better, but still probably shouldn't have been on stage yet. And we would do it again. And just said, you know, you're bulletproof and young and you have an attitude, so you just push through that stuff.
And then, so not long after you got to New York, you got the Comedy Central sketch show, which lasted for a few years.
Donnie is the first documented case of what we have labeled magnumus obliviofallocytus. In layman's terms, that is having an enormous penis, which you are unaware of.
Yeah, so just want to show you some of the safety devices I've developed for little Donnie, helping lead a more normal life.
Well, I have to say that I don't like these devices. I think they call attention to his disease. I think they make him feel different. And, you know, his penis is really not that big.
All right, honey, his penis accounts for over 13% of his total body weight.
Okay, you know what? We don't need to talk about this.
Mommy, I got a chocolate milk mustache!
What was sort of the conception behind that show at the time? Because it was more sketch than the sort of long – you weren't doing the type of long-form improv that you're doing on
stage.
No,
it was sketch. It was always to be sketch. We never wanted to do an improv show on TV, or in the early days at least.
Do you think that would have worked, or do you think – I mean, well, do you think it could have worked?
It can work. We've made a couple specials. I don't know. Improv's tricky. Like, I don't have an answer for how to capture – my gut is like improv has to be shot in a very like – choose your own adventure way, maybe, mm-hmm. to make it work. I'm not sure yet how to yeah. shoot improv, but we've made a couple shows that are funny, and obviously live it works amazing. But what we did for the TV shows, we borrowed the structure of the Herald. So one thing we did is we would write our – the first season was basically all these sketches we had done in Chicago and in New York at various open mic nights and variety shows. So we had a lot of material, but we would organize them thematically, and then we would sort of – this would be our restaurant show. This is our mafia show because it seemed to have a theme. And then we would think of a prank that could happen in that world, take a character and put them in the real world and film it. But also in the way that the Herald has first beat of three scenes, second beat, mm-hmm. third beat where it all comes together. We did that same structure, much like a Tarantino movie where he launches like mm-hmm. 12 characters and lo and behold, they yeah, all intersect yeah. at the end. We were trying to do that in a half hour, mm-hmm. in a sketch show. So delivering yeah. sketch, also this overlay of the secret organization called the UCB, and then also sort of closure by inner strange and surprising coincidence or connection.
Yeah, I mean, that's an ambitious undertaking.
Very ambitious, yeah. And running a theater. Yeah. And teaching classes on the weekend. Mm-hmm. Like we were
so that was always
fire.
Kind of part of it. The classes aspect of the of UCB came from all the way back then.
Before we got a theater, what we ended up doing is we would teach classes and then Ian was our accountant and he would put the money in his wallet and then we would use that money to like, oh, let's make a short movie now. Mm-hmm. Let's go to LA for one show where the head of Fox Casting is going to see us and maybe give us a sketch show, which never happens. But we would do things like that mm-hmm. or props, you know, buy mm-hmm. props for the Monday night bit we do at Luna Lounge. I need two pizzas and I need a case of beer. All right, Ian, take it from the accountant.
So at a certain point, that show, the sketch show ended, and I don't know the exact timeline, but Amy Poehler went to SNL.
Yes.
That's not why the show ended, right? I mean,
no, we were done.
Yeah.
We've ended in 2000 is probably our last UCB yeah, season. And then I don't know when she started.
I think she started 2001.
Yeah.
Cause I know the 9/11 was right around her first, episode.
Was it?
Yeah, I think so.
I was at the Daily Show when 9/11 yeah. happened. Yeah.
Oh wow. Yeah. yeah. Well, I guess we go to SNL next. But what was that like being at the Daily Show when 9/11 happened?
You know, it was insane. It was just I lived at 22nd and 7th, and then Ian happened to wake me up that morning, and I checked the news. I'm like, whoa. I'm
yeah.
Just completely depressed, and I went downstairs, and I had a bike, and my roommate at the time and I rode as for some reason I went down to it on my bike, mm-hmm. which is dumb. And got as close as we could to the barricades and just saw everyone leaving and spent the day trying to donate blood up at the blood bank by Lincoln Center. And yeah, I don't know. Nobody has a good 9/11 yeah. story. It was
do you remember the first time you kind of had to do comedy after 9/11?
Well, UCB probably did – was 9/11 on a Tuesday?
Mm-hmm.
I think we might have gone up Thursday. And I think
– wow.
I think Letterman might have announced he was going up – Thursday
mm-hmm.
and I think we were like, all right, let's do a show. And what was I was in the room when we first, because it 9/11 is an event for me that I thought the world will be forever changed,
mm-hmm.
you know, just nothing will be the same. And so to see a show like 2 days after that in our little improv theater, every scene, whatever they referenced, felt like they were talking about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? You could say dog. And then you're thinking of the dog sniffing around mm-hmm. the rubble to find a survivor. Like anything they did conjured up 9/11.
Yeah.
So it was very strange. But it was also people trying to move on in the only way they could. Like, we don't have any skills. We're not going to rescue anyone. We can't drive steel out of the city. So let's do comedy mm-hmm. for each other at the very least.
Yeah. So, after the UCB show, Amy went to SNL. Did all of you audition for SNL at different points, or was that just her, or did you ever audition for SNL?
I never auditioned for SNL. I would assume like Amy was probably on the radar because she's a standout and she's a woman. Mm-hmm. Like she had both qualities, and I bet she was on the radar when we were on UCB. So when UCB was no longer going, I'm sure they said, "Would you like to audition for our show?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was that a dream of yours to be on SNL, or was that something that you wanted?
I think by the time I got done with UCB or done with The Daily Show and thought like, oh, what if I did SNL? I was too old. At some point I'm like, yeah, that's not for me anymore. I can't. Because after The Daily Show, I ended up in LA. It was sort of – so no, I never auditioned for SNL. They didn't come knocking on my door either, so who knows?
I did see that you made a couple of cameos under Adam McKay in a couple of
weird shorts.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that funny?
How did that happen? He just called you up.
Yeah,
and said,
he's old school UCB.
Yeah.
He came out of Chicago with us. And like many of our friends, Adam was a dear person and would employ us. And you could get $300 by standing in the background covered in blood for his commercial parody or whatever. So it was always welcome. And the same with the Conan guys. They would put us in their silly sketches, and that's what paid the rent.
Yeah. So, you know, UCB from those early days has obviously gotten so enormous and so influential, and you guys have theaters in LA and New York and everything. I mean, how involved, you know, are you day to day what's become really this big institution, like maybe like Second City used to be when you were when you were coming up?
Yeah, in some ways we have become the institution. It's true. I'm very involved. I wish I didn't have to be. Businessman is not my best suit. Yeah,
you didn't set out to be a businessman.
I did not set out to be a businessman, but I'm also very proud of what we've created. We've sort of, in the way that Dell taught me, like, oh, you can be a professional comedian, improviser. I think UCB has taught people, like, here's some things you can learn. Here's like a structure. Here's a community. You can hook up with people who are also making things and filming things. And I like that we can turn people on to this art form called improv, because I remember when I did my first improv class in Chicago at a place called Players Workshop of Second City. It was the only place in Chicago teaching improv back in 1986, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a drug. It was understanding like, oh my God, this, nothing makes me happier than this thing. Mm-hmm. So I like that we've created a place where people can turn on to that drug.
Yeah, and it's become this incredible breeding ground, in a sense, for comedians on SNL, on all across, you know, TV and everything. So are you proud of that that legacy that you guys have created there?
I am, and I like too that if I was a kid interested in comedy, I would be all over the UCB, is all I can say. Like, you can go in there on a Tuesday night and see if whatever $7 show, and Patton Oswalt comes in and does 20 minutes for no reason other than he's working on something or he wants to be silly with his friends. Like, the amount of talent, he's one example, but so the amount of talent that comes through there is ridiculous. And I also think it's like a cool, like, learning community. Like, we have these Q&As where, like, I'll rope Dave Mandel to come in to the Inner Sanctum, which is like our student union, and I'll interview him about improvised television and the art of improv in television or writing for television. Like, so he's like a world-class showrunner. On a Saturday afternoon, you can pop in for $5, I don't know, whatever, and then ask that guy questions. It's not like Comic-Con or anything. It's like, so there's events like that always happening. Like, I'm very proud of those FYC panels that when the horse race happens, like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I snuck my son Emmett into that one too, because I have a key. I snuck him in. But, like, you know, those shows, you know, The Good Place or AP Bio, and you see the banners around Los Angeles. So I'm very proud of that. We're sort of a library of comedy too. Like, I think we put out a lot of good stuff or educate people in good ways.
Yeah. I mean, the flip side of that incredible legacy is that over the years, you know, you have faced some criticism for not paying performers in certain cases. Do you have any, you know, response to that? What people say about that?
people saying, why don't you pay performers? I guess it's just not our business model.
Yeah. I mean, it's classes and people get stage time is sort of the idea there, right?
Yeah. And the hope is that people catch a break and make a living in show business, or mm-hmm. they can network. I guess you're sort of networking there too. Like mm-hmm. my hope for anyone who comes through there is like occasionally we throw kids an industrial gig. Like you can write a terrible industrial for Gillette razors mm-hmm. and you'll get paid $500 to write that copy. Like yeah. those kind of things are paid, but to do an improv show or a sketch show, it still has that gymnasium learning mentality.
Yeah.
And then for people who are like, don't want money like Patton or Sarah Silverman mm-hmm. or yeah. Scott Aukerman, they just like the nature of the audiences that are built into that room. Like mm-hmm. we try to keep the prices low. And in terms of performers, I still think we treat our performers really well because they don't pay for their, rehearsals. When we came out of Chicago, you had to pay every time you had a lighting guy in the room
yeah.
and you had to pay him, and then you had to guarantee tickets. So, and then you couldn't leave props mm-hmm. and there was no support, and they didn't treat improv or sketch like it was worthy theater. It had to be long and dramatic. Mm-hmm. So I think we try to serve people in that way.
Yeah. So you have a film coming up that I wanted to ask about, starring opposite Isla Fisher in Unplugging. And you wrote yes. on this film as well.
We haven't filmed it yet. We're hopefully getting out. No, it's a fair question. In August, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so basically a couple has to save their marriage, so they put their devices down for the weekend. No iPhone, no cell phone. and they go to like a resorty/wilderness cabin. Mm-hmm. And it's very stressful for them. And then they get a little freaked out because like the Wi-Fi goes down and then the power goes out. So then they think like, oh my God, is the grid down? Have we been invaded? They get a little too scared.
Yeah. And yeah. You're a writer on that?
Yeah.
As
me
well?
And a buddy of mine, Brad Morris, who's mm-hmm. a super funny Chicago guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We wrote that.
Did that come out of a wanting to talk about unplugging from devices and social media and all that?
Well, what's funny is like on date night with my wife, I'll try to make her drive because yeah. she'll say I'm always on my phone, but she is always on her phone. And it forces her to like, we have better conversations. You know what I mean? Like
car,
it's date
yeah.
night. Like
yeah.
you can't, cause if I'm driving, she'll be like
yeah.
rolling social media or like she'll be, or she'll be working, you know, planning things for the kids or, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like all goof off, but so it is definitely, I think it's in everyone's life. I think it's an yeah. interesting thing we're going to have to figure out.
Yeah.
Obviously, because there's all these studies that say that, you know, it's bad for you and the frenetic sort of attention span, it doesn't do well. And you shouldn't be doing it before you sleep because it keeps you awake. Mm-hmm. You don't sleep as deep. Or if you have it by your head in the room when you're sleeping, it's really bad for you because it does actually keep your brain aroused somehow. So, yeah, I think it's something we all have to deal with. So I guess I am a little interested in it.
yeah. I mean, is there anything else, besides that movie coming up that you're excited about that you're working on, especially now that Veep is over? I mean, it must, you know, it's bittersweet, I'm sure, but you also freeze up time to do other things that maybe you couldn't have done, when you had that show.
I'll hopefully be writing something with my wife that's loosely based on her dad and my dad, one being like super lefty and the other one being super conservative.
Sounds promising.
Yeah, it's a good
comedy.
It's a good world. Yeah, yeah. And then I don't know, a lot of kids stuff. We have three kids, and just doing a little writing. I wrote a short story the other day that I want to finish.
Yeah,
but nothing, no big projects other than the movie that we'll hopefully be filming mm-hmm. in August. Yeah, and the Del Close Marathon.
Yeah,
which is in June.
Yeah, are there any shows or people involved that you want to shout out?
We do a show called Director's Commentary, and we pretend like we're the cast and crew of any television or movie thing that you might find on DVD. So mm-hmm. we'll be doing that again. We've probably been doing that show for 20 years. There's also the bit shows that they're the 15-minute late night slots that start at like 2 in the morning on Friday or mm-hmm. 2 in the morning on Saturday. And they're usually thin premises like To Catch a Predator prov, where they just keep capturing a predator. They'll do a quick scene and then John Stossel will come out and say, you've been trapped. And then they'll just clean the stage and they'll do another one. Do you know what I mean? They're very silly. Or they do 1976 Mets and it's just introducing Mets. The whole 15 minutes is just introducing different Mets and people come out. There's a show called Match Game that gets rowdy. So, yeah, those are the highlights. Ascat, there'll be a couple good Ascats. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to checking out some of the shows.
Yeah, so, it should be fun. I'm excited.
So before we wrap up, one thing I want to do is kind of these are all people that we've talked about a little bit in this conversation, but go through a list of some of these early people you worked with in the early days at UCB and just see if there's a story or a memory that kind of jumps out when I mention their name. So first is Matt Besser. A memory that jumps out for you?
The thing that came up the other day was reminded of is I met Besser at a comedy club in Chicago, and he gave me like – he was just out of college or something. He gave me like – he saw I was funny on stage. He's like, I'll do a sketch with this. So he gave me like three sketches he thought were really funny. Mm-hmm. And he's like, read these. We'll do them here at this open mic. And I never read them. And then like 3 weeks later, he's like, did you read them? I'm like, no, I'm sorry. He's like – can I get him back? So that was like our first meeting.
Yeah.
I blew off his sketches.
Did that continue the dynamic between you guys?
Yeah, we got off-footed. We've never been able to get past that.
And then next is Ian Roberts.
Ian was like one of the best like straight men for the classic term of like providing logic and improv. So I think I've learned to improv. I've spent so much time improvising with Ian. I think I've learned to be like a better improviser because he's just really good. One of the best at like extemporaneously justifying anything weird that happens on stage or understanding quickly what a scene is about. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of like a Ian memory. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's always into some phase of fitness. Like he always works out and he's always got some interesting powder or interesting.
Was that always the case? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Throughout there was a summer where he was like biking everywhere and he got super fit and then somebody hit him on his bike and he's like, I'm not riding a bike in New York anymore. Mm-hmm.
Amy Poehler, we talked about, but what were sort of your first impressions of her when you met her?
I think I met Amy on stage for my Second City touring company audition. Mm-hmm. So I met her. We were both auditioning and they just randomly pair. And I remember we did a scene together. I'd kind of maybe known her from the scene, but I'd never met her. Mm-hmm. Long story short, she was really funny. And I'm like, oh my God, this gal's really funny. This person is really funny. So that was my first impression of Amy. She's like, she's really funny. And then I guess when we started working and doing scenes with her, she was always really cool. I don't know. Is that a good first impression?
Yeah, cool and funny. Yeah. Amy Poehler.
Yeah, that's on brand.
Adam McKay, who has gone on to become this massive film director, and but he started out with you guys as well in Chicago, which I think a lot of people don't know. So what was he like in those early days?
Adam was a force of nature who came out of Philly into the Chicago improv scene by way of there was a guy named Rick Roman who was like an early Upright Citizens pack kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And he was a buddy of Adam's. And Adam was just a breath of fresh air and also like his own force, you know, brilliant, brilliant mind and really good improviser and very subversive and very like aggressive sense of humor. And I think he inspired a lot of people. And I remember like, he could just make you laugh. He was so goddamn funny. But doing a lot of crazy pranks where we would call pizza places to scam pizzas and stuff like that. He had a lot of like balls, pardon my language. But yeah, he was brave. So I remember, I think of that when we had no money. I think of like McKay calling into a pizza place down the street and then me having to walk in and get it as his assistant or something.
And then last is Horatio Sanz, who was also very involved in those early days as well. I know he was kind of known for some of his Gonzo.
Gonzo is a stuff. Really good way. I toured with him at Second City, and I also performed with him, and kind of physically fearless, and a real talent. Just always been a real because he's a really great actor. And but Gonzo and unpredictable and would, I don't know, do crazy shit at parties. Yeah. Like, what are you doing? Oh, no, now we got to leave. I remember one night we were up on a roof at an improv party, and it was like, I don't know how we got up there, but it was an A-frame house.
Mm-hmm.
So we climbed up the steep roof just to sit on the top of this peak in Chicago, like two stories up,
yeah,
at a house party. And I think the cops were like yelling at it because we were by the end of it, we were singing. And the cops were like, you guys have to get down right now. So I don't blame him for that, but I always have fun with him. And he was in my wedding. He was one of my groomsmen.
Oh, nice. So the final thing that I ask everyone on the show is what's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? Think of it as a kind of recommendation for listeners. Could be something you saw on TV or at a live show.
Well, much of comedy for middle-aged people is about their children.
Mm-hmm.
So my son, Emmett, the other day was at some camp and they're doing icebreakers where you meet people. And it was a pet camp. And basically the teacher, the counselor was like, okay, everybody pick an animal and say what you sound like or whatever. So my name's Tina. I'm a cat. Meow. And then it got to Emmett. I'm Bob. I'm a dog. Roof, roof. And it got to Emmett. And Emmett's thing was like, hi, I'm a whale. I'm from New Jersey. Does this blubber make me look fat? It's a funny bit, right?
Yeah.
And my wife told me that story over the phone and I cackled. Dear sweet Emmett is really funny. He's a lovely boy. See? Solid bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the last thing that comes to mind. Yeah. Or one of the things that comes
maybe
to mind.
Maybe he has a future in comedy following his dad's footsteps.
Yeah, he might. Yeah. He's in the right town for it.
All right. Well, thanks, Matt. This was great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Matt Walsh for being my guest on today's show. The Del Close Marathon will run from Friday, June 28th through Sunday, June 30th in L.A. You can get tickets now at delclosemarathon.com. If you enjoy this show, please, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazel. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
I think we know the rest of the story.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.